Pasyatam Chanirudam Nam Tarbharata Sukhavasya Goswami said, Apasyatam, who did not see cha and anirudam aniruda tat his bandunam for the relatives cha and bharata O descendant of bharata Parikshit Maharaj chatvarya four Vashika of the rainy season. Masaha the four the months. Yes. Vyatayo past. Anusochatam who were lamenting. Yes, who were lamenting. Translation and purport by the followers of the His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Sukadev Goswami said, O descendant of Bharata, the relatives of Aniruddha, not seeing him return, continued to lament as the four rainy months passed. So I'll read on until we find the purport, for that is the etiquette. Text 2. After hearing from Narada the news of Aniruddha's deeds and his capture, the Vrishnis, who worshipped Lord Krishna as their personal deity, went to Sonatapur. With Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna in the lead, the chiefs of the Satvata clan, Pradyumna, Satyaki, Gada, Samba, Sharana, Nanda, Upananda, Bhadra and others converged with an army of 12 divisions and laid siege to Banasura's capital, completely surrounding the city on all sides. Banasura became filled with anger upon seeing them destroy his city's suburban gardens, ramparts, watchtowers and gateways, and thus he went out to confront them with an army of equal size. Lord Rudra, accompanied by his son Kartikeya and the Pramatas, came riding on Nandi, his bull carrier, to fight Balaram and Krishna on Bana's behalf. Purport. Sridhar Swami states that the word Bhagavan is used here to indicate that Lord Shiva is by nature all-knowing and thus well aware of Lord Krishna's greatness. Still, although Shiva knew Lord Krishna would defeat him, he joined the battle against him to demonstrate the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur states that Lord Shiva entered the battle for two reasons. First, to increase Lord Krishna's pleasure and enthusiasm. And second, to demonstrate that the Lord's incarnation as Krishna, although enacting human-like pastimes, is superior to the other avatars, such as Lord Ramachandra. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti further states in this regard that Yogamaya, Lord Krishna's internal potency, bewildered Lord Shiva just as she had bewildered Brahma. In support of this statement, the Acharya states the phrase Brahma Rudradi Mohanam from the Brahma Rasamrita Sindhu. Of course, Yogamaya's job is to make fine arrangements for the Lord's pastimes, And thus Shiva became enthusiastic to battle against the Supreme Lord Krishna. Om Gyanatmanandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmulitam Jena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So of course, whenever you go to movies, it's two topics that people are mainly interested. One is fighting, and the other is romance. And so we see in the dramatic enactments of the Lord's Leela, these two things are also prominent. Here we have a battle. This chapter is called Lord Krishna Fights with Banasura. So the lead up to this was the previous chapter, and I believe yesterday there was a verse on the board from chapter 61, and today there's a verse on the board from chapter 63. So that means Aniruddha Prabhu, who actually features in this pastime, Aniruddha of course is Krishna's grandson, the son of Pradyumna, who is the son of Krishna and Rukmini, their first son actually. So I think Aniruddha is the first of the grandsons. Aniruddha Prabhu yesterday read through an entire chapter. So we'll recap that anyway, just to give some background to the story, so we understand what's going on. The situation is introduced in the previous chapter, the meeting of Usha and Aniruddha, that Banasura was a great, powerful demon. Demon because his name is Asura, Banasura. He was actually a great devotee of Lord Shiva. Now, many times we think of demons as like, you know, especially if we're conditioned by the Western concept, as a demon being, you know, some red fanged creature with big horns and so forth. But a demon in the Vedic idea is not like that. A demon is somebody who is grossly materialistic and considers himself independent of the Supreme Lord. So many times the demons were very cultured, as we see in the case of Jarasandha. And also Banasura, he was very honest and intelligent, and he honoured his worshipable deity, Lord Shiva. And he was very, very powerful. He had, because of his worship of Lord Shiva, he was benedicted with 1,000 arms. And he pleased Lord Shiva with these arms by playing drums. When, you can imagine 1,000 arms beating on drums. When Lord Shiva wanted to do his Tandava Nritya. What is Nritya? Huh? Dance, yes. Because we know Mahaprabhu Kirtana Nritya Gita. Kirtana accompanied by Nritya, dancing. Lord Chaitanya relished this, and as devotees we relish this. So, sometimes Lord Shiva is known as Nataraj, Lord of the Dancers. King of the dancers. Krishna is also known as Nataraj because he dances on the heads of the Kaliya serpent and thus establishes the Mridanga beats by beating on the skull, the various skulls of Kaliya. He establishes drum beats. The Lord Shiva is also Nataraj, and his particular dance he likes to perform is the Tandava dance. Now, from my previous association with Mayavadi yogis, I know what the Tandava dance looks like. And also, many times you see statues of, or little murtis of Lord Shiva, and he has his arms out, and he's kicking up to one hand. And as when I was associating, before I was a devotee, fully practicing devotee, I was with a yoga group and they used to do the Tandava dance. Ideally, you should have a dagger in one hand and a human skull in the other hand. And then you kick out alternately each opposite leg to each hand. So this is the Tandava dance. Lord Shiva performs it with great relish. And Banasura assisted in Lord Shiva's relish of his Tandava Nritya by playing drums. And thus further pleased Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva offered him a benediction. You may guard my... Banasura said, please guard my city from attack. Please be the chief of my city's guard. And Lord Shiva acquiesced and did that. So Banasura had one very beautiful daughter. No, actually, well, continue, make another point. Banasura, he had so many arms, but they were very itchy in terms of he wanted to do something with them. They were powerful arms. And he complained one day to Lord Shiva, look, you've given me all these arms, but because I'm so powerful, nobody can stand up to me in battle. And thus my Kshatriya arms are itchy for a fight. And the only thing I can do to satiate them is beat them against mountains and tear mountains apart because of my itchy arms. Now this is an interesting point because all of us have strengths and talents and energies, especially when we're young and youthful, we're full of energy. Now, that energy tugs upon us. Use me. Engage me. I want to engage my talents. I want to engage all my youthful energy. And ordinarily, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 9, where Krishna says, Yagyartat karmano nyatra, loko yam kama bandhanaha, bound by karma, kama bandhanaha, tad artam kama kuntaya, mukta sangha samacharaha. That the ordinarily work or activities causes bondage in the material world. Therefore, work done as a sacrifice to Vishnu must be performed, otherwise you'll be bound. Therefore, O son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duty for his satisfaction, and in that way you'll remain always free from bondage. So this is the process of devotional service for dovetailing one's propensities, one's energies, in such a way that you will not be bound, not be conditioned by the work performed or the work born out of one's nature. Repression is not the process of purification in bhakti yoga. It's not that you simply try and push down your propensities, sit on them, and try and not get entangled in the material world. That is very difficult, as Krishna describes in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that for the yogi who is not practicing bhakti yoga, very difficult. Because the mind, simply trying to control the mind and senses, withdraw them and keep the mind steady and balanced, constantly dissipating one's material desire simply by the strength of the mind. This is a very difficult state to try and remain, to realize, okay, if I get active in this material world, I'm going to be entangled. Therefore, let me become inactive. So therefore, they do meditation and so forth. And they try and keep the mind steady. But Krishna says, if the mind focuses on even one of the roaming senses, the intelligence becomes dragged away. What does that mean? The intelligence begins planning. How am I going to execute these desires? And one's focus on self-realization is lost. Therefore, it's a difficult situation for the non-devotional yogi. Even a man of intelligence becomes easily lost in his quest for self-realization. So bhakti yoga is the simple solution. Simply, whatever you have, whatever quality it may be, whatever strength, whatever energy, simply engage it in the service of the Lord. Make it a yajna, sacrifice. Because at every moment, whatever we're doing, we're sacrificing. Every moment that passes, you're sacrificing into the great eternal time. Every moment that passes is gone. And somehow or other you're engaging that. Every time you act for any purpose, you're performing a sacrifice. Whether you're sacrificing for your own sense gratification, whether you're sacrificing for your boss at work, whether you're sacrificing for your parents, for the mind and senses, you think it's for yourself when you're doing what you want to do, so-called. But actually, what you're serving and what you're sacrificing your energies for is the mind and senses, which are demanding of you. So at every moment, we're sacrificing. So Bhagavad Gita states that the ultimate enjoyer of all sacrifices is the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, Krishna. And by performing devotional activities, one is not bound by reaction. This is the process. This is how you become liberated. And actually we see that practically. If you have some propensity, just say you're a singer, you like to sing, you feel good about yourself when you're singing, you feel people also praise you when you sing, then there's a good chance that you'll be attached to that. If you're a conditioned soul, you'll be attached to whatever your strengths are, because they boost. And therefore you want to do that naturally, because it's good. It's the line of least resistance to glory, or to whatever your strength is. You want to do that. You'll be attracted to that, you'll be attached to that. But that attachment binds one to false ego. So how to become detached? Simply engage that propensity in glorifying Krishna, in glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the beginning, this is called Karma Yoga. There's nothing wrong with Karma Yoga. Everybody starts with Karma Yoga. That means to give the fruits of your actions, offer them, sacrifice them. Not for me. The result is not for me. Simply, I maintain my body and soul together, and I do what I want to do, what is natural for me, but I offer the result to Krishna. This is called Karma Yoga. And gradually, by that process, it's a simple process. How does it work? Oh, you give a little bit to Krishna. Oh, that was pretty good. Next time I'll give a little bit more. Oh, that's okay, that's good. Give a bit more. Wow. So then you eventually give up everything. You give up your attachment to that. You simply think, whatever I do, as long as it's devotional service, then I will be happy. So what happens then? Do you give up singing or do you give up your propensities? No. You continue to do that, but you're completely detached from it. You continue to do that because that's the most effective way you can serve. But it's not that you're attached. So that is the process of becoming liberated actually from our conditioned nature, is to engage it. Realize, okay, yes, I'm attached. But I will engage that attachment to a particular style of work in the service of the Lord. And this way, gradually that attachment will become dissolved and I'll become attached to the abstract principle of devotional service. That is the process. So you see Banasura, he had his many arms and his great strength and his fighting propensity, and he was frustrated because he wasn't able to utilize that. There was nobody who could stand up to him in battle. So he felt this gnawing, this itching, and he couldn't satisfy. So we feel that as well, especially when we're young. We've got so much energy. What to do with it? simply control your mind and senses? No, you should not repress that energy. You should engage it wholeheartedly in the service of the Lord, whatever you have, whatever talent. And the more you become purified, actually, the more you understand what you've been given, what your particular shape is, what your particular gifts are, what you're best at, and what comes easily and naturally for you. That's what you should do in devotional service. Of course, you shouldn't be like... we shouldn't be stubborn and obstinate and say, well, this is what I'm good at, this is what my strengths are, so therefore I'm not going to clean the bathroom because that's not my strength, you know. Scrubbing tiles is not my strength. No, we shouldn't be like that. We should do the needful. But the bulk of our service, eventually, as we become more and more settled and situated in devotional service, should be in our strength zone. Because when everybody's working in their strength zones, things are very excellent. Because whatever you're strong at, you generally do with excellence. Of course, in the beginning, especially, new devotees, young devotees, especially should do, you know, this is, I know Aniruddha and Achintya Rupa are very strong on this policy, and it's well known, it's well understood. Even like an apprentice, when he first joins a master to learn a trade or an art, he will do very menial, quite menial service. But that is good, because it's a test, actually. Is this person interested in simply, you know, engaging their propensities, or are they actually interested in devotional service for the sake of the satisfaction of the Lord? So in the beginning, there needs to be some humbleness demonstrated and some attachment to the actual principle of devotional service. Therefore, menial service is good. And it's always good, you know, because really, truly we're servants. We're not... That's how we have to see ourselves. And servant means to do the needful. So in the beginning, yes, humble... A quota of humble devotional service especially should be there. But gradually, as one discovers oneself in devotional service, tries a few different services and finds where one is strong, then one should act in that capacity for maximum return in Srila Prabhupada's mission. Things become very excellent when people are acting in their strength zones. And if you're weak somewhere, another person will be strong there. So the person who is strong in that department, they should work in that department. And in this way, things go on nicely. Because just like in your body is constantly making cells. Cells for the liver, cells for the brain, cells for the different parts of the body. You cut yourself, more cells are made to fix the skin up. So in this way, the body is constantly producing what is required for different departments of the body. The body has departments. Digestion department, you know, working sense department, locomotive department, thinking department, blood purification department, elimination department, waste disposal, has a reproduction department. The body has different departments. Similarly, human civilization has different departments. That's why there are different varnas. But a varna is not a mental concept superimposed on people. It doesn't mean you are a sudra because your father was a sudra or whatever. Therefore, you have to work like this. Or you are a brahmana automatically because your father was a brahmana. It's not like that. It depends on the quality of the person. Their natural attraction to work. So that can be understood by somebody with clear intelligence, and eventually we can discover that for ourselves. And what is natural? What is the natural way for us to work? So Krishna is saying that this is a natural system. In other words, it's just like the body, where cells are produced according to the requirement of the body. Similarly, people take bodies and within human civilization in the appropriate proportions to fulfill the needs of human civilization. Because you need the worker, you need work to be done, you need people to manage the production of economic necessities, you need people to protect and govern the society, and you need intellectuals to guide and teach. So, naturally, different bodies have been produced with the different propensities. So, yeah, discovering oneself and one's strength and one's propensity for work is a gradual process, but it's very necessary, and that's where one will be happy and feel very comfortably situated in devotional service when they're working in their strength zone. At the same time, the aspiration is to become detached from that and become attached to the abstract principle of devotional service to Krishna. Whatever it is, whatever I'm doing, I don't really mind, as long as I'm serving Krishna, somehow or other. So, Banusura was frustrated, because how to engage the strength? So he said to Lord Shiva, "You gave me these arms." You know, Lord Shiva is his lord and master. But still he says, in a kind of a obstinate way, "You gave me these arms, but now they're itchy. I can do nothing to satiate my desire for battle except beat them upon mountains and tear mountains apart." And Lord Shiva said, "You are a great fool. One day, your flag of victory will be broken and it should fall. And you will meet a proponent who will destroy you." What was Banusura's response? "Joy! I look forward to that day when I can satiate my fighting spirit on a suitable foe." He actually said, "Lord Shiva, you're the only one. Why don't you fight? Let's have a fight." "You fool." He said, "Don't worry. One will come and you'll be put in your place." So Banusura had a beautiful daughter, Usha. And Usha lived, she was a princess. She lived in the inner chambers of the palace. Doesn't mean inside, but in the inner quarters of the palace. There was gardens and many nice things in the inner quarters of the palace with her girlfriends and so forth. She was unmarried, but she was approaching marriageable age. And one evening, while sleeping, she had a dream. She had a dream that a beautiful young man with swarthy complexion and very nicely proportioned features was kissing her. And she was relishing very dearly the nectar of those kisses. And then she awoke from her dream, crying, "Oh, my lover! Oh, my lover! Where are you? Why did you leave me?" And then she suddenly looked around and realized she was surrounded by all her girlfriends, you know, who were also sleeping, but they'd woken up with her exclamation. And then she suddenly felt very embarrassed. And she hung her head in shame. And then her friend Chitralekha, who was the daughter of Banasura's prime minister, approached and said, "My dear friend, what is the meaning of your exclamation? And she said, "Well, in my dream, I saw a beautiful young man, and I was relishing the nectar of his kisses, but then he suddenly disappeared, and I woke up. This is the meaning of my exclamation." And he said, Chitralekha said, "This is strange, because you have never seen a boy, even." But Usha said, "I must confess, I'm very attached. I'm very attached to this boy." And Chitralekha said, "Never fear, don't worry. I will bring him to you. But first we must identify who he is." So Chitralekha means one who is very expert in drawing or painting. So this was her talent, and she engaged it in service of her mistress. And proceeded to draw many different drawings of all the different denizens of the different planetary systems. And every time Usha would go, "No, that's not him, that's not him." No. She'd draw many different pictures. And eventually she started drawing pictures of the Yadu dynasty. And Usha started to get a little bit excited. And then she drew a picture of Pradyumna, who was Aniruddha's father. And she became a little bashful, a little shy. Oh, very close, but not quite. And then she drew a picture of Annie Ruder. And she hung her head and smiled and said, "That is the boy." So Chuchulaika said, "Okay." And she had mystic powers. So traveling upon the subtle airwaves, she appeared in the palace in Dwarka and snatched a Neruda. Picked him up. She's mystic, Yogini. And transported her, he was sleeping, transported him back to Banasura's palace, into the inner chambers. And he appeared there and he was like, "Whoa, okay, what's going on here?" But very quickly he was charmed by the affections of Usha. And she worshipped him very nicely with different items and great attentions and affections. And in this way captured the heart of Aniruddha. And it captured his senses as well. And he was fully engaged. Sometimes it's said the wife is the fortress. Bhagavatam explains this, is the fortress of the senses of the man. And it even says that, you know, it's okay for the wife to decorate herself very nicely, even though she's a devotee, in order to charm the senses of the man and keep them focused on her. And in that way, that allows the man to be focused on one, rather than drawn in so many different directions in the material world. So in this way, Usha was doing that. She was acting in such a charming way that Aniruddha was fully absorbed in her. And anyway, after some time, it became apparent to the various minders of the women's quarters that there were symptoms in Usha's countenance that she was enjoying a conjugal relationship. I'm not sure whether that was meant, what it exactly meant by that, but anyway, she symptoms. And any girlfriend will know when their friend is like having some kind of relationship, you'll see the symptoms and be able to tell intuitively. So this was reported to Banasura, who was furious, because this was a great disgrace for a Vedic family. That prior to marriage, a daughter or some member of the family, female member of the family, engages in a conjugal affair. This is completely unheard of. It's completely disgraceful. Because that destroys the chastity of womanhood. So Banasura entered the chambers in a great fury and then saw Aniruddha was sitting there quite calmly, quite relaxed, you know, with Usha, you know, completely unperturbed, just looking at her, and he had a flower garland on, and there was marks of kumkum powder from the breasts of Usha, where she had embraced him. And he was just sitting there. Banasura walked in, and he just... and Banasura was furious, and he sent his soldiers to attack Aniruddha, and Aniruddha just stood up, picked up an iron rod, a club, and just beat off all the soldiers. The description is given that it was like a boar mauling hunting dogs. Boars are very powerful, determined creatures. You hear stories of demoniac hunters going into the forest and being chased by boars and mauled by them with their, because boars are stocky little creatures, sometimes quite big actually. The tusks, you know, so they just throw the dogs around. You know, the hunting dogs converge upon it. You know, normally dogs like to take the neck, but boars have no neck. Practically, it's just like this ball of muscle with big horns on it. They're just throwing the dogs around, you know, ripping them apart. So this is the description given. Aniruddha, very nonchalantly, just destroyed all the soldiers that were trying to take him. And then he proceeded to but then Banasura arrested him with the Naga Pashu, which are the ropes, naga ropes, snake ropes, and kept him bound. So that is the prologue. And then we come to this chapter. The 4 months of the raining season had passed, and Aniruddha had not appeared. He just disappeared one night, and then for 4 months, then he didn't appear. But then Narada came to the dynasty, and worshipped Lord Krishna, and told them of his capture, where Aniruddha was. And then they prepared to go to the to siege Banasura's city and win Aniruddha back. Yeah. So what happens then is a massive fight, a fight on a massive scale between the soldiers of the Yadu dynasty and Banasura's armies and Lord Shiva. And we see many things here are quite mystical. For example, Lord Shiva is riding on a bull. And then, most astonishing, tumultuous, hair-raising battle then commenced, with Lord Krishna matched against Lord Shankara, and Pradyumna against Kartikeya. Kartikeya is, of course, the god of war. And what does he ride on? Who knows?
Peacock.
That's pretty far out. Lord Balaram fought with Kumbhana and Kupakarna, Samba with Bana's son, and Satyaki with Bana. Brahma and other ruling demigods, along with the Siddhas, Charanas, and great sages, as well as the Gandharvas, Apsaras, Yakshas, all came in their celestial airplanes to watch. So you can imagine all the sky decorated with celestial swan and flower airplanes viewing the battle. Kumbhakarna riding on his peacock, Lord Shiva on his bull, and they're all throwing mystic weapons, you know, see, because Vedic warfare is chivalrous. It relies on the prowess of the individual warriors. Just like in ancient Japan and so forth, you'd train as a samurai or a ninja or whatever, you know, you'd do a martial art and it would be like many years of practice and you'd become very powerful in martial combat. And this way your respect that you received in battle was based on your prowess. And the citizens, you know, the civilians weren't pulled into these kind of battles. It was between the Kshatriyas who were that way inclined. And it was treated much like a sports game. Yeah. And, you know, the warriors were so powerful they even had mystic weapons. Of course, warfare these days has no chivalry involved. In the Wild West, who knows what the great equalizer was, what it means. The great equalizer. The gun, yeah. Basically, because you could be like a samurai. I remember from my past conditioning, I remember watching one movie, Three Musketeers or something. And this, like, the samurai comes on the deck of the ship, you know, with these two swords. Does all these fancy things, you know. The guy pulls out a gun. So the point is, you know, You could be like a trained samurai ninja, you know. You grew up in a Shaolin monastery or something, you know, carrying pails of water down to the river every day with, like, anyway, there are all sorts of things they do in these movies. Training up, you know, one finger handstands, all these far out training activities, and then some kid comes along with a gun and shoots you, you know, with no training at all. It's a great equalizer. It takes all chivalry out of battle. And these days, you know, industrial warfare is industrial. You know, produce big bombs in the factory, just shoot them off with some computer, you know, some computer nerd is like wiping out, you know, thousands and thousands of warriors, and, you know, just sitting there, push, enter, you know, city's wiped out, you know. Yeah. And the so-called leaders of the army, they sit in bunkers with their little, you know, connectivity, you know, with all their computer screens and everything, and they fight the battle from afar. Yeah. It's industrial warfare, you know. You put some guy into battle with a flamethrower, all he needs to do is pull the trigger, you know. So in this way, warfare has no chivalry involved, but in the Vedic times, very chivalrous. It depends on the prowess of the individual. In this way, the strongest, most worthy party won, not the person with the biggest firearm. So anyway, we see that many things here are very, very far out. And this is a point that we encounter quite a bit when we get deep into the Vedic knowledge, that there are many things you know, outside of what we think is even possible. Sometimes we think this is fantastical. So how to take it? Is it true? Did it really happen? Is it true? Is it allegorical? Is it meant to convey some deeper principle? You know, some abstract principle, and they're using this specific thing. Are we supposed to take it literally? Are we supposed to interpret it? To what degree? So these are questions, you know, all, you know, Christians have this, how to interpret Genesis, how God was walking in the heat of the day in the Garden of Eden. No, he was walking in the cool of the day because he didn't want to get hot. God was walking with his legs. You know, Christians wrestle with this. But does God have a body? Does God have sweat glands? We must have to interpret it. It's talking about there was a tree of knowledge with a forbidden fruit. You should not eat that fruit. What does it all mean? Did it really happen? Or are we supposed to interpret it that this is the abstract kind of reality? All have sinned. There's a division between us and God. You know, are we supposed to take it allegorically or literally? So we all have to wrestle with this question. Now, Prabhupada's standing. I'll read you something actually. Prabhupada Zavacharya. This is from The Great Transcendental Adventure, which is Korma's book. It happened right here in this room. Prabhupada was sitting on his Vyasasana, and there was. Here we go, I'll read it. The room was hot. Two bare-chested brahmacharis, standing on either side of Srila Prabhupada, fanned him reverently with yak-tail whisks. Raghunath, a middle-aged devotee householder, was having difficulty in coming to grips with the Bhagavatam's descriptions. Instead of studying his spiritual master's books more carefully, he had made the mistake of studying books from the Theosophical Society, which had only furthered their compounded his doubts and confusion. He raised his hand and asked sheepishly, Srila Prabhupada, when it is cited in the scripture that Lord Brahma rides on a swan, a hamsa, is that, are we to take this to mean that it is a real swan? Or is it something symbolic? Prabhupada sat taller in his Vyasasana. Not symbolic. It is fact. What do you mean to say? Symbolic? Why do you say symbolic? Raghunatha answered with some reticence. It's rather unusual. Prabhupada opens his eyes wide. Unusual? What experience have you got? You have no experience. Have you got experience of other planetary systems? What is there? Then, your experience is very teeny. So you should not calculate Brahma's life and other things from your teeny experience. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita it says the duration of life of Brahma, Sahasra Yuga, Paryantam Ahar, Yad Brahmano Vidur. Now, a Brahman's life is stated in the Shastras. We have already explained that we accept the authoritative statements of the Shastra. Now, Brahman's life is stated there. Arhat means his one day is equal to 4 yugas. 4 yugas means 4,300,000 years. And multiply it by 1,000. Sahasra Yuga Paryantam. Sahasra means 1,000 and Yuga means 4,300,000 years. Now multiply it by 1,000. That is the period of Brahma's one day. Similarly, he has got one night, one month, one year, and such 100 years he will live. So, how can you calculate? How is it within your experience? You will think something mysterious. No, your experience is nothing. Therefore, you have to take experience from the perfect person, Krishna. Then your knowledge is perfect. That I have already said. Don't try and understand everything with your teeny experience. That will be... Then you will be a failure. So this is Prabhupada's consistent stand. You know, even when the fifth canto came out, and, you know, with all its wonderful statements about the structure of the universe, the moon is further away than the sun, so many different things, the hellish planets. Devotees became very confused. What does this mean? Should we take it literally or not? Or, you know, the cosmos working according to, you know, cogs and levers. Stars and planetary systems working according to these things. And you notice, when you read the fifth canto, Prabhupada never says this is allegorical, this is metaphorical. He just says it straight up and just gives his purport. You know, Bhagavatam is saying this, and he just comments directly. He never suggests that it's meant to be interpreted in any way. And this confused the devotees greatly. And then what he did, he was interviewed one time about it by the press, and this is Prabhupada's approach. He sat up, you know, to the press and said, yes, the moon is further away than the sun. He proceeded to boldly argue this point. And he gave the example, he said, because Monday comes after Sunday. Monday comes after Sunday. Therefore, even your Western civilization understands this point. I heard this from Ravindra Swarup, you know, in one of his lectures, and he said, and nobody seemed to be able to figure out or ask the question and say, Prabhupada, what does that have to do with anything? But just by his countenance, by his presence, by his convictions, everybody was just dumbfounded at it. Okay, I guess so. So what did this do for Prabhupada's disciples? It showed them that he was not going to budge. That his faith was unbreakable on the subject. So the point is, what Prabhupada is saying in his admonition of his disciple is that you don't actually know very much. Huh? The Supreme Personality of Godhead is beyond space, time, and thought. You are completely bound by the limitations of space, time, and thought. You have a very short life. You are born in ignorance and darkness. If you don't become Krishna conscious, you will also die in the same condition. See, what tends to happen to the conditioned souls, they get a little bit of knowledge about how things work, you know. I know how to program a computer. Science has taught me this. Therefore, I know what's possible and what's impossible. So a little knowledge closes the door to a greater understanding. And makes the thing, now I know, everything's in its place, everything compartmentalized. We understand reality as it is. I know what's possible, I know what's impossible. This is complete nonsense, because always there are things turning up that baffle the boundaries of science. That baffle the preconceptions of the scientific mind. And science doesn't actually mean to hold a bunch of preconceptions about the cosmos. Science means to follow the scientific method, which is to hypothesis, experiment, verification. So that's why science can be applied to Krishna consciousness as well. You have a hypothesis, I am a servant of Krishna, you perform the process and you verify, get realization. So but this is the kind of human condition. We get a little bit of knowledge and then we think we know everything. But this is not good. We have to keep an open mind. Because, you know, we look at the history of the world, so many amazing things are consistently reported, you know, extraterrestrial experiences, ghosts, telepathy, levitating with the mind, all sorts of miracles. They're reported. Science, of course, says, humbug. But if you even read David Redaswamy's book, Search for Vedic India, it has like documented scientific studies done on reincarnation and past life regression. Young kids been able to remember their past lives. People have done scientific studies on it, it's all documented. And the evidence is so overwhelming, it's pretty hard to argue against it. But because it doesn't fit the conceptual paradigm of the mainstream scientists, they block it out. They put a knowledge filter on. Therefore they accept, you know, what fits in with their preconceived paradigm, and they reject that which doesn't. You know, they've got this idea of evolution, they're attached to it. That's the point. You're attached to it. And even though there's a missing link, a big missing link, and even though there is there's all sorts of anomalies, like things discovered, skeletons, human skeletons discovered that far predate the time when they should have been around. So many anomalies come up, they say, anyway, don't worry about that. And they just brush it under the rug, and they know, this is true. You know, because, why? Because we're attached to it. So this is the human condition, tend to be dogmatic. Actually, what we have to realize, and this is a very deep point, we have to realize this, that we're bound to subjectivity. We have four defects. In the conditioned state, we have four defects. Who knows what they are? Number one, imperfect senses. That's a major defect. That means, you think, oh yes, this is marble, you know, this is wood, the world out here, I know what's going on, because I can see it, I can perceive it with my senses, I can hear things, I can see things. But your senses are very imperfect. You can't, it's a little degradation of the eye, and you can't see things. You misread things. You take some hallucinogenic drug, and you see so many things that aren't there. You can't see very minute things. You can't see things on a very great macro scale, like the cosmos. You can't even feel the world turning, although the world is actually turning pretty quick. Now, if you were to put a stationary point, you know, you'd find that it's moving pretty quick. You know, it's very quick actually, spinning through space. We can't sense all these things with our senses. Our senses are imperfect. And the mind, all the you know, do you know that the eye is actually, the structure of the eye means the image that comes into your brain is upside down. And you know, if I was to hang you upside down for a few days, initially you'd see things as upside down, but then after a few days, you'd start to perceive it as the right way up. It's true, the brain would flip it over. You know, bats, for example, they have the sonar. So they have a different type. They can't see anything, but they have sonar, so they send out waves and it comes back. So everybody, you know, there's something here, you know, some kind of world around us. But to know it as it is through our senses, or through instruments we develop to extend the range of our senses, microscopes, telescopes, this and that, is actually an imperfect endeavor. We can never know the world perfectly through our senses. What are the other defects?
Cheating propensity.
How about this, you know? there's evidence outside of my the paradigm that I'm attached to, the theory that I'm attached to, therefore I'll disregard it. You know, I'll bend the stats, you know. I'll bend the stats, you know. I do some study and there's some stats, you know, and I have to give a report, but it doesn't match my hypothesis, so I'll bend them, I'll slant the stats. That's quite easy to do, actually. You know, governments do it all the time. Even if they don't bend the stats, they make a graph in such a way that, you know, something that's supposed to look like this, they just build the graph in such a way that it looks like this, you know. It's higher, this one's higher, but it's not. You can't see the... You slant the statistics. That's cheating. We cheat ourselves and we cheat others. Next one. Illusion. There's three states of consciousness. The wakeful state, dreaming state, and deep sleep. There is daydream and nightdream as well. In the conditioned world, when we're hypnotized by our desires and mental conceptions, we're actually dreaming. You know, you're sitting there, you're listening, whatever, you're doing something, you're spacing out. You're thinking about so many things and projecting your own conceptions onto everything you perceive. You're imagining things. Maybe in the future it'll be like this, maybe like that. This person doesn't like me. Oh, I think that person does like me. And if they do like me, then perhaps in the future it'll be like this, it'll be like that. You fantasize. Huh? You wake up in the dream, you just had a dream of some violent dream or something where you've been attacked, and you wake up and you feel all fearful, and that kind of fearful feeling, that residue of fear within the in the body, chemically, remains. And you kind of carry that fearful state, and then you might and you might be kind of jittery for the rest of the day. That's because of some dream you had. So we're in an illusion, in a big way. And if you don't know who you really are, in the ultimate absolute sense, then you're an illusion. And yeah, we're constantly illusioned. And finally, the propensity to make mistakes. So these four defects bound us very much to subjectivity. Subjectivity means that we are... There may be an objective existence out there, but we perceive it in our own way. Because we, according to our subjective experience. So everybody is perceiving life in a different way. This is subjectivity. So understanding this deeply, we don't actually know the nature of this world, the nature of reality. This energy that surrounds us on all sides, this is God's energy. And God can do with it, Krishna can do with it whatever he wants. We think the laws of nature work like this, but Krishna can bend them just like that. In past ages, the laws of nature may have worked differently. In different parts of the cosmos, they can work differently. There is no absolute laws outside of the will of God. Or the will of the Supreme. So, understanding that our perception is very much dependent on the super soul, we become humble and we realize, actually, I don't know what is true and what is not true. And then, therefore, Prabhupada says the solution is to accept the authoritative statements of Shastra. Anyway, that's a very deep point. Very important, actually, to meditate on, become humble. The more you know, the wiser you become, the more you realize that due to your condition, you don't know anything. And simply you're in need of mercy, revelation, which you'll get through sincere bhakti. So, any questions or comments on these points? Yes, Mataji. I don't have a tape measure right now. Yeah, you'd expect. But that's not how Krishna works in his Leela. He plays along with the drama. Oh, yeah. Whether he knew or yoga, or he allowed himself not to know. He plays with the drama because that's what his Leela means. God has nothing to do. So why does he get so busy with all these pastimes? To have fun. And to engage his devotees in loving exchanges. Anything else?
These
are the sons of Krishna, apart from Pradyumna. Yeah? Krishna had 16,108 wives. With every wife, he had 10 sons and one daughter. So it's a lot. And each of them had 10 sons and one daughter. So the Yadu dynasty was pretty big, vast.
Big army.
Yes.
I just want to ask that, you know, I heard one of the lectures that, you know, usually there's always fighting going on between this world, there's always fighting going on between the mind and this, and between the senses. A constant fight, and there cannot be peace in the battle. So, and even while chanting, you know, the like, thoughts will just rush, you know, so many different thoughts. And if you're not even thinking, all of a sudden will just come, you know. So, and when you stop chanting, it will again stop, you know, it will be a little less. So why does it happen that while chanting only, everything just...
Yeah, I was watching my mind this morning, actually, I was thinking, then I saw one of the Indian boys walking around the room chanting. I was thinking, is that guy I saw on the tram? No, it wasn't that guy I saw on the tram the other day. The guy I saw on the tram the other day, he does, selling green power, you know? And then I started thinking, I wonder if they get a commission, they get paid, you know? My mind was all of a sudden, and I said, how did I get to this? All of a sudden I was thinking about corporate remuneration systems, you know? And I thought, how did I get to that? And then I realized the mind is so quick, you know, I traced it back, and I thought, yeah, okay, the mind is very quick. So yeah, there is always that's why we have to control the mind, control the senses. And that's the practice, that's yoga practice. Huh. The mind will suggest so many crazy things. And with your intelligence, with your spiritual intelligence, you have to discriminate on what is appropriate, what is inappropriate. And you have to practice fixing the mind on Krishna. Because if you actually can fix your mind on the holy name, the holy name will touch your heart and you will develop love for Krishna. But if you space out while you're chanting, you won't taste the holy name and then you won't develop attraction for Krishna. So it's a practice. It's hard work and it will continue through this life. But it does become easier as we become detached from things. We become detached from things over time by consideration, by realization, and by also engaging our attachments in devotional service. You know, gradually, like I used to take drugs and things. Now, you know, if somebody sparks up a marijuana cigarette in my presence, I won't feel drawn to do it. I'll just go like, take it away, I'm not interested, you know. But in the early stages, you know, if somebody did that when I was just trying to break my habit, it would have been very tempting. So in this way, as one becomes detached and attached to the more and more to devotional service, and therefore protective of one's pure state of mind, one's devotional state of mind, one will be careful not to engage in thoughts or activities which degrade one's consciousness.
It just comes, you know, like, it's not that.
Yeah.
When you try to stop it, you're not going to think about it. I mean, it's just like,
yeah. Coming. Yeah, then you bring it back again. That's the practice. Oh, yeah, as soon as you notice, you bring it back. As soon as you notice, bring it back. As soon as you notice, bring it back. As soon as you notice, bring it back. Oh, there it goes again, bring it back. That's the practice. Oh, I'm spacing out again. Bring. What am I supposed to do? Chanting, that's right. Okay, so I'll chant. Then 10 seconds later, oh, bring it back. That's the practice. And by doing that, you become stronger. And you become, you know, your stamina grows. You know, like in the beginning, you do some running, you're training for a marathon. In the beginning, you can only run 100 meters, and then you That's enough for today. Next day 200, next day 300. Eventually you're doing 20 kilometers, you know. It's training. You strengthen the mind. It's like muscle, you strengthen it.
You have to like Muhammad Ali.
Huh?
Like Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali. Yeah, Muhammad Ali, you know, he was thinking, I have to go into the ring with George Foreman. George Foreman, you know, he had this punching bag. And the punching bag was had a huge dent in it, you know. Sometimes you see, you know, when they're building big buildings, they have a huge weight. They have these like 50-foot long concrete pylons, you know. And they have this big weight that goes down. And it drives it into the ground and then it pulls up. And it's just, and this 50-foot, you know, 50-foot pylon driven into the ground, you know. So he was like that. A huge man. Muhammad Ali was big, but in comparison, quite small, you know. So what was his tactic, you know? And George Foreman was especially good at cornering the ring as well. You know, Muhammad Ali's thing was dance like a butterfly, sting like a bee, you know. So he jumps around, dodges. But Muhammad Ali, George Foreman, you know, was quite big and cumbersome. He was very good at cornering the ring. So just use his footwork and somehow that you'd try and dance out of his way, but all of a sudden you'd find yourself in a corner and just, and then he'd come in. You fall, knock you out, you know. So he's a very formidable opponent. So Muhammad Ali thought, what should I do, you know? Perhaps my dancing like a butterfly and stinging like a bee approach won't work. So he said, and so instead what he did is he did thousands and thousands of sit-ups every day in preparation for the fight. When he got into the ring, what he did, and everybody was so surprised, everybody thought, he's finished. What he did is he went against the ropes, and he just led there, and he had his guard up, and George Foreman just came in, and Muhammad Ali taking in the gut, and all the time, you know, every now and then George Foreman, and he kind of rest his head down for a while, and Muhammad Ali would whisper in his ear all these taunts saying, what's happening, big boy? You're losing, running out of steam, are you? And everybody thought, Muhammad Ali's finished, you know. Nobody can do that against George Foreman. He's too powerful. He'll be crushed, you know. And the organs will rupture from all this pounding. But, no, Muhammad Ali's abdomen were like, it was like a sack of bricks, you know, because of all the work he'd been doing. And eventually George Foreman became tired out. And then Muhammad Ali suddenly leapt to life off the ropes and did a few quick jabs and things and knocked him out. That's what happened. That was through his training, developing that strength. That was his strategy. So I hope that's a useful.
Yes. What are the words 14
Bhagavad Gita? Bhagavad Gita is 3.9.
3.9.
Yeah. Work sacrifice. Work done as a sacrifice to Vishnu must be performed, otherwise work causes bondage in this material world. Okay. Therefore, O son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duty for his satisfaction, and in this way, you will always remain free from bondage. This is my friend I was talking about who sells power. I was speaking about you in the class. The great soul, Mahatma.
Here he comes.
Okay, thank you very much. Gontraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.